Hello, and welcome to Media Evil, a medieval pop culture podcast, where we talk about how medieval and medieval-inspired movies, TV, and books depict the medieval world. What did they get right? What did they get wrong? And what do they tell us about how modern people see the medieval past? I'm Sarah Ifschecker, a medieval historian, and today I'm joined again by Media Evil's resident Doctor Who expert, Lily Bonneman, to talk about 2011 Doctor Who episode, The Curse of the Black Spot. So, Lily, welcome.
Yar, it's nope, I'm not gonna do that. Hi, it's good to be back.
Pirate appropriation.
I don't think I can maintain a fake Cornish accent for 2 hours.
No, that seems like too much. I feel like we just need like one like terrible pirate joke.
Yeah. Oh, I've got one. What's a pirate's favorite letter?
R.
A letter of safe conduct from His Majesty King Charles II of England.
Oh, solid. Good historical joke. Lily, you are not, in fact, Cornish, but I have
No.
somebody who has guested on the podcast who is actually Cornish.
My ancestors are from Gloucestershire.
Yeah, there you go.
That's close.
Yeah. So, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and about how you came to be Media Evil's Doctor Who episode, as usual, in case there happens to be somebody for whom this is their very first episode of the podcast?
Sure. I've been doing this for years. No,
Almost as long as I have.
about 4 years ago-ish, I was talking to Sarah, found out she had never seen Doctor Who before, and I was like, we should fix that. Because there's a lot of Doctor Who that's like within the wide scope that this podcast calls medieval. Since your definition goes as late as the 17th century, I am personally shocked that this is the first episode you've ever done addressing pirates.
Yeah, part of that, to be honest, is that I have not seen Pirates of the Caribbean since realizing that Johnny Depp seems like he's a terrible person.
Fair.
And I'm not
I
sure that
also.
I want to see Pirates of the Caribbean again. So,
Also fair.
yeah.
But my
Like,
best
it's
friend's
because I have
Ryan.
like a lot of like nostalgia for it because I really enjoyed it, when it came out and when I was like, I don't know, in high school or something like that. And so I feel like the like disjunct would bother me.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking
Yeah.
more Muppet Treasure Island, but.
That would be fun. That'll have to do one of these days.
Yes.
We are now getting into The Curse of the Black Spot. So this is series six, episode three, came out in 2011. And we have, in fact, the same TARDIS team as we did last our last episode, which I think might be a first for this podcast.
It is. Yep.
Yeah. In fact, I feel like I barely even had the same doctor twice.
I've had five three times,
Yeah.
but with different companions each time.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah.
Tegan was there twice, but Tegan was there forever, so.
Yeah. But yeah, so we have once again Matt Smith as the 11th Doctor and Karen Gillan as Amy Pond and Arthur Darvill as Rory Williams. And I am delighted to be able to say that their relationship now seems normal.
Yeah, Arthur Darvill has now been promoted to opening credits. So,
Yay! Congratulations to him.
because he's in every episode this season instead of only like half of them.
Yeah, so that's exciting. And we also have in this particular episode a couple of people that I'll note are Hugh Bonneville as Henry Avery, who of course is best known for his performance as the dad in Downton Abbey.
Lord Grantham.
Yeah. And we also have Lily Cole as the Siren, who I've seen actually in a couple of things. She was in that movie, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which was that weird movie that was kind of already weird. And then Heath Ledger died before they'd finished filming. And so then they got all of these other actors to play like transformed versions of Heath Ledger as he went into like different times or something.
Okay. I've not seen that one.
It's a weird movie. I'm pretty sure I only saw it because I was sad that Heath Ledger had died, and I don't think it was very good. But,
That is fair.
shout out nonetheless, for to Lily Cole for having, worked with Heath Ledger in his, I believe, last role. And she is also very briefly one of the rich people gambling at Canto Bight in The Last Jedi. You will not be surprised to hear, given Star Wars, that there is like an elaborate additional backstory that exists for her that is like absolutely not under any circumstances apparent while watching the film.
Oh yeah. No, the bigger shock is that I don't know it.
I mean, I don't know it either. I just looked it up, saw that it was longer than I would expect it for a character who's in like half a scene, and then moved along.
I grew up reading Star Wars expanded universe novels. None of that shocks me.
Yeah, that's classic Star Wars.
Enumeratio.
So at this point, we can get into the plot of our episode here. I will note there is apparently a like prequel clip that exists
And
that I
I didn't
didn't
see that one.
watch. So I only know about it from Wikipedia, and I mention it solely because it provides some introduction to the situation, and in that it gives an exact date in which this takes place, which is in April of 1699. So I just mentioned that because I will mention the precise date later on briefly. So that is my
Wow.
establishing information.
Very late in our allowed period of
Yeah.
we're going as late as the 17th century.
Yeah, so everybody, fair warning, this is like a little beyond what I would consider my primary area of expertise. But there are points of connections that I'm able to make. So, but I don't have anything especially intelligent to say about like the costumes or anything like that. So, so we open on this pirate ship. And we see this guy who seems extremely upset at the fact that he has gotten this tiny little cut. And everybody's like, oh, you're doomed now. We as the audience are sitting there watching, being like, you essentially have a paper cut. But he also then is marked with a black spot on his palm. And they
Spooky.
announce that the siren is coming, at which point I write in my notes, I bet that's a new kind of alien.
Well,
I mean,
not
about which
quite,
I was not
but
entirely correct, but
no, but
and so he does not make it, bless him. He is the siren comes and takes him by the hand, and he evaporates.
And then the other pirates go out on the deck and they're like, poor guy. And then they hear more some knocking from below decks and they're like, the sirens come back. And they open up the hatch and are like prepared to strike whatever's there. And it's the Doctor, Amy, and Rory.
Yes, to which the doctor says, yo ho ho, and then pauses and says, or does no one actually say that?
Oh, such a good line.
Really enjoy that it seems like the doctor and Amy in particular are like really enjoying pirate stereotypes and then keep running into the fact that I guess the pirates do not know that there are pirate stereotypes and seem confused. So the doctor explains that he has sensors that led them to this ship. They don't understand what sensors are. He attempts to explain sensors in the parlance of the 17th century.
My ship sort of automatically noticed-ish that you're in a spot of bother.
He tries to then kind of identify with them as, I'm a captain, a ship's captain just like you, and then kind of pauses and goes, except for the gun thing and the beardiness. Pirates are unimpressed. They send the doctor to walk the plank. They then send Amy down to below decks. I think Rory is also meant to be walking the plank in a moment. And Amy finds a sword and a hat. She can't. You can't. You can't. You can't go all out with a sword and the pirate thing unless you also get the hat.
And the pirate coat.
Oh, yes, I have the coat, right? So you need like the full garb. So she gets garbed up and goes back to rescue the doctor and Rory. And you immediately also see that there's something odd going on because most of the other pirates are fighting not actually with swords, but with like staffs and things like that. And then they also have guns.
Yeah, one of them's
And
got like a knotted rope he's swinging around. One of them's got like a big stick. And they are more scared of Amy with a sword. And Amy clearly doesn't know how to fight with a sword
No.
necessarily. They're a lot more scared of her than you'd think that would warrant.
Yes, exactly. So they seem very concerned about the possibility of getting even the smallest cut. She does cut someone who is immediately horrified, and she also accidentally, I guess at some point, I think she sort of drops the sword or the sword goes flying and
Yeah,
nicks Rory.
someone knocks the sword out of her hand. It goes flying, nicks Rory on the hand on the way
Yeah.
by. I think the subtitles identified the pirate who gets cut as the bosun.
Ah, yes. So there are now two new injured people receive the black spot. The siren appears. The siren evaporates the pirate. Amy and the doctor are working quite hard to grab onto Rory and keep him from going toward the siren, which he
Yeah.
is very enthusiastic about doing. So we do have our kind of, classic siren in the sense that she is singing, and her singing is attracting these is kind of luring these individuals who get injured, all of whom do happen to be men.
They're also like acting very silly. Like they're acting like kind of drunk. Like Rory stumbles over to Amy and he's like, "You are beautiful."
Yes, but then he also comments on how beautiful the siren is, and she has
True.
a moment. She has a moment of being just a bit jealous here, which having come directly to this from the vampires of Venice, I kind of like don't feel that bad for
Yeah.
her. Yeah.
When the siren leaves, Rory kind of comes to his senses and he's like, "What's that look for?" And she's like, "She's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen." Oh
He's like,
no, did I say that?
So now that they are trying to figure out what's going on, and we have the first of the doctor kind of figuring out various theories, most of which do not turn out to be entirely correct.
Yeah.
As indeed was my theory of this must be some new kind of alien. That seems to also be the doctor's working theory initially, some kind of variant of that.
In fairness, like that's usually what it is, so.
Yeah, no, you can't blame him. And so its first assumption is that the siren is using water as a portal and using that to appear in different parts of the ship. And so they go into the ship's magazine, right, which is very dry because if it's wet, you might damage all of that gunpowder. So it's a part of the ship where there is a, heavy effort to make sure that things are completely dry. And when they enter, they find a stowaway who turns out to be the ship captain's son, Toby.
The captain's name is Henry Avery, which we probably mentioned during the cast list, but
Yes. And little Toby Avery, bless his heart, still labors under the delusion that his father is a very honorable Navy captain.
clearly in Navy garb and these fine, honorable, upright gentlemen with him. Ah, oh, poor kid.
I'm going to assume the fever is clouding his brain,
Yeah.
that he
Yeah.
has not yet been like disabused of this notion that his father is an honorable Navy captain.
Because he is very sick.
He is very sick, and his mother has died.
And his mother has died, yes. So he can't really go home again.
Yes.
And he's like, "I want to join your crew." And his dad's like, "No, you're not joining my crew. I don't want you here."
We also get the additional complication at this point that we see that Toby also has a black spot on his palm. And so here's where we realize that it's not just an attraction to the scent of blood or something like that. It's an awareness of some kind of sickness or weakness.
Yeah, it's she's going after the sick and the wounded.
Yeah. And in fact, that, his fever is probably significantly more serious than most of these cuts. So.
True, because the doctor later identifies it as typhoid, which pretty nasty.
Yep, a lot of people do not make it through that. They're trying to figure out what to do at this point, and the doctor's suggestion is that maybe we can all escape on the TARDIS. So he and Captain Avery go to the TARDIS to kind of try and kind of start this process. I do find it very fun that it actually doesn't take long for Avery to figure out the kind of basics of how the TARDIS works and says something like, "A ship's a ship."
Yep. Yeah, wheel, astrolabe, compass, as he's pointing at various parts of the console, and the doctor's like, wow. Because
Not totally
the
wrong.
doctor's like, all of this is far too complicated for your little human mind to handle. Just don't bother.
Yeah, and he's like, "It's a ship. I figured it out." I do always appreciate those moments in Doctor Who where the people from the, pre-modern, early modern world are not dumb.
Yeah.
Right, because every now and then the show does kind of rely a little over much on the, everyone in the past was so superstitious and stupid and doesn't understand all of these things. And so I like when there are these moments that we do get, like this one, where he's clearly, his skills are, when relevant, right, are, real and valid and allow him to figure out pretty quickly, right, that a ship's a ship.
And this actually is a Chekhov's gun. It'll come into play later.
Yes. Yes, indeed. However, despite the combined navigational awareness related to the TARDIS of the Doctor and Captain Avery, the TARDIS is not cooperating and runs off on its own, which is
Yeah.
described as being something new. So I gather this is not something that has previously happened in Doctor Who lore.
No. At least not in this manner. There is a system on the TARDIS called the HADS, the Hostile Action Displacement System, which causes the TARDIS to leave on its own if it lands somewhere dangerous, which can strand the crew there for an entire story. But the Doctor usually keeps that turned off because he doesn't want his ride running away from him when it gets dangerous.
Fair. That seems like kind of more of a bug than a feature, arguably.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to take off right when it lands with him still in it, but there's usually like just of enough of a delay for him and his friends to step out.
Okay, I have questions about the rationale for this that I'm not going to ask now. I'm going to bring them up again later
Okay.
about the rationale for the TARDIS disappearing. Meanwhile, back in the ship, the pirates are attempting to disabuse poor young Toby of his notion that his father is a nice Navy captain by talking about all of the innocent men they've seen his father murder.
Yeah. We fly under the black flag, the Jolly Roger. And then Toby's like, "No, you liar!" And he grabs a sword, and they're like, "Put that down, lad. You don't know how to use it." And he says, "I don't need to, do I?" And he nicks one of the pirates on the hand.
Yes, and this pirate is then taken by the siren in an area that does not have water. And at this point, I believe that the doctor is the first time the doctor says,
No,
"Get rid of all of my previous
it's
theories."
the other one that the one that he did. Didn't cut, like, leaves
Oh,
his
yes.
comrade behind, goes to get all the treasure, and the doctor and Captain Avery like spot him, and the doctor's like, he's got the last of the supplies, we should go after him, and Captain Avery's like, never mind the supplies, he's got my treasure.
Yes, and then he is taken by the siren, and what they realize is that the the means by which the siren is arriving in different rooms is not simply water. It's specifically a mirrored or reflective surface of any kind. So this can include still water. It can include mirrors. It can include very shiny polished metal, which the pirates have a good deal of.
Uh-huh.
They actually run back into the magazine, and there's this little medallion that Toby has that he's like idly polishing that the doctor then grabs and starts like blowing on to make it no longer a good reflective surface.
Yeah. He's like frantically breathing on this medallion. It's a pretty funny scene.
Yeah. They then start going around and breaking mirrors into comments that, you know, it's bad luck to break a mirror, but, you know, how much worse could it get? Which seems like the kind of classic thing that you say before it does indeed get worse.
Yeah. But in this instance, it doesn't really get worse right away. Like, Captain Avery's like, I understand. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. They also are, well, the doctor is trying to throw the treasure into the sea. The captain is rather resistant, commenting that, you know, this is a treasure of the Mughal of India, and like, but I want all this stuff. This is why I'm a pirate, is for all this stuff.
And the doctor's like, the siren's coming after all of us. Like, human beings, you're so fragile. Yeah, like at some point, all of you will bruise.
Right. The doctor, right, is unsurprisingly being, you know, very, very pragmatically concerned. Avery is, in a lot of ways, still more concerned with the treasure question than he is with the, you know, siren coming and killing everybody question.
And actually, this reminds me of, it's a callback to the classic series, to a very early... a First Doctor serial called The Smugglers, which we didn't cover because I think most of the episodes are missing. But in The Smugglers, like, the Doctor and his companions have to deal with, like, Cornish pirates who are looking for the treasure of Captain Avery.
Oh, fun.
So now... all these decades later, we know what happened to the treasure of Captain Avery.
Indeed. Indeed. So a storm begins, and so they're like, great, we can set sail, we can get away from the siren. The actual crew is at this point, I guess, basically all dead, right? So I think it's just, maybe there's one left? Or is it everybody's dead? No, it is everybody's gone. Yeah, so it's just Avery and the kid, and then the doctor and Amy and Rory. Poor Avery, bless him, is trying to give instructions to Amy and Rory, who have never sailed a ship before, particularly not in the 17th century, and do not even understand what is being asked. And so at some point, Avery says something like, put the bunt into the slack of the clues. And Amy's like, I swear he's just making half of this stuff up. And Rory's like, I think we might need a phrase book.
And then... Over the noise of the storm, it's like Captain Avery yells, "Heave ho, you bilge rats!" And it, Rory's like, "All I caught was rats."
Yeah. So between not understanding much of the vocabulary and not being able to hear very well, things aren't going great. And then to make matters worse, they had put a bunch of the treasure rather than throwing it overboard. They kind of put it in a sack. And Toby drops the sack, and out comes a nice, shiny crown, and through that reflection comes the siren, and the siren takes Toby.
Yep.
Then, to make matters worse, Rory falls overboard and seems to be drowning, and the doctor suggests that, in fact, we call the siren to save him because we don't know 100% for sure that when the siren takes people, she kills them.
Well, and also, like, the doctor calls Captain Avery out on his fatal flaw of greed.
Yes.
Look what it's cost you.
Yes.
It's cost you your commission, your wife, your son.
Yeah. And then at this point, they all prick their fingers. So, in all being at this point, we've really only got Avery, Amy, and the doctor. They all prick their fingers and are voluntarily taken by the siren so that they can see what's happened to Rory, Toby, and I guess everybody else. And they arrive in a spaceship.
A spaceship that is out of phase on a different, like, sort of plane of reality, but existing in the same space and sort of crashed and stuck there.
Yes. And we see that the entirety of the original ship's crew, who are clearly not human, they have some
Rat
sort of head
aliens.
spike situation.
Rat
Yeah.
fangs, kind of a
There's like a
sort.
rat, but then there's also like some like interesting additional things going on with their head. I don't know. But they're some interesting looking skeletons that they think died from exposure to some human disease that, you know, they were not inoculated against properly, of course.
Yeah. As the doctor is like examining and explaining, he sort of like casually leans on the on a console and he's like, oh, it's alien sneeze. Alien bogeys. And he ends up wiping his hand on Amy's shoulder and they just carry on.
And then they find a sick bay. The doctor has to once again instruct them to ignore all of his previous theories, as what they realize is that the siren is not a killer, but a doctor.
And after, and like at some point, because the doctor's been saying this every time new evidence comes up, he's like, ignore all my previous theories. And at some point, Amy and Captain Avery are like, we stopped listening to you a while ago.
Yep, which is fair. Since at this point we're on like explanation three or so.
Oh, more than three, I think.
Yeah, so what they figure out is that the siren is the ship's virtual doctor. So the reason she's kind of green and glowing is not that she's some sort of demon or magical creature, but that she's a computer simulation. And that what she's doing is that at any point when she recognizes somebody in her, you know, immediate orbit as being sick or injured, she brings them to the sick bay where she doesn't actually have the tools at her disposal to heal them, but can kind of keep them in stasis, essentially.
Because she doesn't know how humans work.
Right.
But like the du Captain Avery is like looking around the beds and he's like, that's McGrath. He's one of my men. These are all my crew.
It's like, oh, yep, whole gang is here. So yeah, so this is where basically the entire fairly substantial crew is at this point. And of course, also Toby and Rory. Rory, as it turns out, because when he was grabbed up, he was in the process actively of drowning. We've got a bit of a challenge here. So or we have two challenges. The first is that the siren interprets any attempt to touch or you know, or interfere with the bodies as, you know, as being a problem and like goes red and gets very angry.
Well, not only are Toby and Rory there, so is the TARDIS.
Yes. Oh, yes. The TARDIS is there as well. And this is the other question I have. Does that imply that the TARDIS is sick or injured?
Maybe? I'm not actually sure. It's
Like, why would
possible.
the TARDIS go there?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know she couldn't take off because of, like, what we eventually learn is the dimensional interference of the second ship in the same space. But
Right, but I don't understand why she'd go to that ship. Especially because she's like kind of like in the sick bay, right?
yeah,
Yeah.
she might have been trying to take off and crashed into the other ship or
Yeah.
something. I'm not sure,
Yeah.
but yeah, we have this this fun little moment where like Captain Avery's like, Toby, and he rushes to his side, and Amy's like, Rory, and she rushes to his side, and the doctor in the exact same tone is like, the TARDIS.
Yes. Equivalent relationship.
Basically.
Yep.
I mean, literally, the next episode is called The Doctor's Wife, and the titular character is the TARDIS.
Oh, interesting. There's also is that like weird bit where that I skipped over because it just kind of is for a second, and it is as somebody who is watching this completely out of context, I had no idea what was going on. But there's this like bit where Amy sees like a woman with an eye patch. She's like, "You're doing great."
She's tied into like the big overarching plot of the season. She's just this, at this point, she's just this strange lady that only Amy can see occasionally. And it's explained later, but like at this point in the season, you're about where everyone else is.
And probably by the next episode we watch, they'll all be gone. Amy manages to convince the siren android that she is Rory's wife and that she wants to look after him and should be able to do so. She has to sign a consent form, which is great. And Rory basically says, "All right, so once you remove me, I'm going to die because I will continue the process of drowning. And you have to use CPR, I guess, and resuscitate me."
He's like, I'm a nurse. I can walk you through this process.
They agree that that's what they're going to do. Avery decides that what he's going to do is that he's going to stay with this ship. He can fly it because a ship is a ship, because this is the only way he can stay with his son.
Because Toby will die of typhoid fever if he leaves.
And at this point, it also kind of makes sense, right? He doesn't have a lot going for him. His crew is gone. His wife is gone. His relationship to legality at this point is presumably questionable at best.
She's like, I can't go back to England.
So, this is a pretty good option, all things considered. So he's ready to basically, take off with this ship because then they can kind of deal with overlapping temporal field situation.
Well, they have to get the ship away from Earth because the doctor's like, what, can you imagine what would happen if it got ashore? Like it'd start taking everyone who got injured like on the mainland, and that would be very disruptive.
This could do a lot of damage, and especially in like 1699, like probably everybody's like just a little bit sick. They take Rory and well, Amy does manage to save him, but it is pretty touch and go there for a bit. I actually genuinely was not sure Rory was gonna make it.
I mean, it's not the first time Rory's died. It's also not the last.
Poor Rory.
I think Rory like sets a record at like 9 deaths in his total time on the
Oh
show.
God, poor Rory.
Most of them get like undone because of time shit, but
Still though,
still
poor
though,
Rory.
poor Rory. Amy's not far behind at like 6, but
Oof. But she does manage to rescue him. The other ship flies off. They're ready to leave in the TARDIS. And then we also get some odd little moments at the end that are presumably pointing to other overarching plots in the season. One is that Amy has a vision of the doctor's dying, which she's told Rory about, but is not telling the doctor about.
it's not a vision. The first episode of this season, like Amy and Rory and River are invited to like this picnic with the doctor, and then they witness the doctor get killed. And then they're like, oh God, what has just happened? They're trying to like process this, and then they run into the doctor, a much younger doctor, one who is 908 instead of 1103. And and they're like, we can't. And River, who knows how time travel works, is like, you cannot tell him that we've seen his death because that is, his future. And that'll, yeah. And that would be bad.
Although, does his death really matter? I mean,
It's
I'm just, it doesn't he just
complicated. It's
regenerate?
immensely complicated. Well, he gets killed in a way that he can't regenerate from, which makes it
Oh.
especially complicated.
Okay. I assume they must have figured out how to regenerate him anyway, but.
Yeah. So, spoilers for Doctor Who Series 6. If anyone else is actually watching this at home and does not want spoilers, fast forward ahead like a minute. So that what the doctor ends up doing is getting this shape-shifting robot that they run into later the season to impersonate him and like take his place for that
Oh.
instance of him getting shot and permanently killed. Because then
Oh.
it's
Like
not
the Prince
actually
John
him dying.
robot.
It's a big old robot.
Like the Prince
It's
John
a it's a
robot.
it, just a bit. Not a big old robot, a regular sized robot, but the people inside are very tiny.
Oh, so interesting. So it is not actually, it turns out it is not actually the doctor who dies. It is the shape-shifting robot. Oh, okay. Good loophole.
The events that Amy and Rory and River saw play out as they witnessed, and yet the doctor gets to keep going.
Yes. So she has this, I guess, memory rather than vision that she is flashing back on that she is not informing the doctor about. And meanwhile, the doctor has his own thing that he is not telling Amy and Rory about, which is that he's got a scanner on the TARDIS, which is a nice pregnancy test scanner, which is simultaneously revealing Amy as pregnant and not pregnant, which
That's.
seems like something even that the state of Tennessee would struggle with.
This is also tied into like overarching mystery plots of the season. It is directly tied to the eye patch lady, but that's all I will say on the matter.
Okay. So yeah, so we've got a lot of things going on, but that does bring us to the end of the episode. So with that, we can move into our Vera et Falso, where we talk about what the film got right and wrong. So as I said, we're gonna go a little light here, but a couple of things that I thought were of interest. So one is that Captain Avery references the fact that he has the treasure of the Mughal of India. And I will say, stylistically, the treasure doesn't really look like anything one might associate with the Mughal Empire of India. Like that crown, in fact, that they keep remarking on, it looks like pretty distinctly Western European, to me, honestly. But otherwise, I think reference works pretty well. So the Mughal Empire is a Muslim-ruled empire in Central and South Asia. So it would include modern-day India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. I think also some parts of Nepal. And it was founded in 1526. So this is an empire that has kind of, that's, as I said, is Muslim. It has kind of Turkic and Mongol origins. It gradually incorporates some elements of Indian culture, but continues to kind of maintain this specifically Muslim identity. This is an empire that at the time when this episode takes place absolutely would have been associated with wealth. So the idea that the treasure of the Mughal Emperor is a kind of particularly impressive treasure makes sense. And so this is thanks in part that we're, you know, we are looking right at an increasingly, you know, a world in which we're kind of increasingly seeing kind of global interconnections. So this is a period where we could talk about the growing European involvement in the Indian Ocean trade and high demand for Indian products. At this point, my exact knowledge of the details are getting a little bit fuzzy, but I think this is probably moving into, you know, the British East India Company, which then ultimately kind of has important role in terms of basically establishing British colonial rule in India. So, you know, big, so, you know, a lot of things going on here. And the Mughal Empire emperors became known for their emphasis on display and consumption. So they're kind of big collectors of luxury objects, they're patrons of the arts. And of course, probably the most famous example that people are still aware of today as a very obvious display of the wealth of the Mughal Empire is the Taj Mahal, which is actually a Mughal imperial mausoleum built between 1631 and 1653. Yeah. at the time that this episode takes place. And so this is where it matters that somebody, that they were kind enough in that little, you know, prequel clip to provide an exact date, that it is 1699. Because of this, I can confirm that the Mughal emperor at the time is Alamgir I, who ruled until 1707. And, you know, again, kind of thinking about people being perhaps particularly impressed with or interested in the Mughal Empire during this period, it is under his rule that the empire reaches its largest territorial extent. As a final fun note, one of the various sources of his wealth would have been, of course, taxes, which also includes that he actually, after a period of, I think, about a century, where the Mughal empires had not actually enforced the jizya, which is a poll tax that non-Muslims have to pay. And this is something that, you know, goes back centuries. Like, this is something that you have in, you know, early Muslim states as well.
Yeah.
And so he reintroduces the jizya. So this tax that then would have been paid by the largely Hindu population, right, of the Mughal Empire, although it varied based on socioeconomic status, and there are various people who were considered exempt, and that he also instituted a rule that Hindu merchants had to pay basically double the custom fee on their goods that Muslim merchants had to pay. So a Hindu merchant would have to pay basically kind of 5% of the value of the goods, whereas a Muslim merchant would pay around 2.5%.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The other thing for this section that I wanted to note is the presence of sirens. Sirens have their origins in Greek mythology. Of course, one famously might remember the scene in the Odyssey, where Odysseus is aware of these beings that lure sailors with their captivating voices, ultimately to their death. He has himself in the Odyssey lashed to the mast so that he could hear the sirens without being tempted by them. And meanwhile, has all of his men stuff their ears with, you know, I don't know, I can't remember, but like they, you know, have the, you know, kind of stuff up their ears so that they can't actually hear.
I want to say cheese, but I'm pretty sure that's wrong.
That sounds wrong.
I don't know what I'm thinking of, but it was people stuffing cheese in their ears to stop from hearing something.
Who knows? But they stick something in their ears. And Homer does not actually describe the siren's physical form, but when you look at both Greek literary and visual sources, they tend to present them as part human women and part birds.
Huh.
Yeah. So this is actually the original sirens are like bird ladies. And then starting in late antiquity in the Middle Ages, you sometimes still get bird ladies, but you also start to often get fish ladies.
There we go. Yeah.
Which is what people tend to think of. Like the word, La Sirena is actually, I think, how you say mermaid in Spanish.
Yeah. When I think of sirens, I think of more mermaids, less harpies.
Yeah. And so that is actually a later development in the history of the siren.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're sometimes half human, half fish. They're still sometimes half human, half bird. Sometimes they're like half human, half fish, but maybe they also have like wings and a bird talon. There's some wild things happening in medieval images of sirens. And you also begin to see it that as sirens get incorporated into medieval Christian art, that we get all sorts of fun morals right around the sirens. So usually it kind of boils down to the idea that falling for the charms of beautiful women in particular, or worldly pleasures in general, will lead you into damnation and the clutches of the devil. Fun fact, sirens sometimes are also holding a fish. And the reason for this might be that fish sometimes represent souls in medieval Christian symbolism. And so the implication is sirens will destroy not just your body, but also your soul, which is a fish. Christians are wild.
Okay. What?
Other facts about the sirens. First of all, sirens are not always female, that there are images that include male as well as female sirens.
Neat.
Yeah. And the sirens are also not always beautiful. that this tends to be part of our idea of the sirens, but in fact, the real focus is often on the idea that, like, the voice is beautiful. That doesn't necessarily mean her appearance is beautiful. So, for example, in one bestiary, Thomas of Cantibre describes these sirens as loud animals, which from the head to the navel have the shape of a woman of great size with a hideous face and very long and scaly hair on the head. And they appear with their young, which they carry on their arms, for the mothers suckle the young, which they have at their breasts. And the sailors, when they see the sirens, are very much afraid. And they throw an empty bottle to her so that while she plays with the bottle, the ship escapes, which kind of seems like how you might distract a cat.
Yeah, a bit. It also makes me think of classic The Legend of Zelda, where empty bottles are some of the rarest and most valuable items you can find in the game.
I wonder if this is a source of that.
Maybe.
His description also has these sirens as being human fish bird hybrids. So it says they have a part on their body like that of the eagle and claws on their feet capable of sculling. But at the end of their body, they have the scaly tails of fishes with which swim like rowers in the sea. And then, of course, states that they have certain musical and sweet melody in their voices with which the sailors, delighted and attracted, are sent into sleep. And the sleepers are torn apart, claws of the sirens. So that's why you've got to have the eagle claws to tear people apart after you lure them.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are all of, so yeah, sirens are pretty interesting figures. This show, however, kind of makes the move of the siren is, as it turns out, you know, a polygram, but is in appearance just a human lady who apparently, in terms of their casting efforts, they were like, we want somebody who's really pretty, but kind of, but in a kind of weird looking way.
Yeah. Yeah, they pulled it off. They got it.
And I was like, yeah, no, fair enough.
And the doctor's like, oh, she must have taken on the appearance of her new patients.
Right. Which, like, you know, makes sense.
Presumably when she was the doctor to this ship full of alien rat things, she looked different.
Right. But it's kind of interesting from, like, a gender perspective in terms of thinking about maybe the sort of origins of, you know, these aliens, that the doctor is a woman.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, what professions tend to be coded as masculine versus feminine in different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I was going to note that the siren does get depicted more often as basically just a human lady in art even later than this. So if you look at paintings of sirens from, like, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, they're just, like, very pretty ladies. So that is later than this period. But I suppose one could make the argument that perhaps this is the influence of where that came from.
Okay.
Sure.
Sure. One more thought about the bird fish, because I brought up The Legend of Zelda. So this has nothing to do with Doctor Who. But starting in The Legend of Zelda, The Wind Waker, which takes place after, like, a great flood has, like, flooded the land of Hyrule and it's now the Great Sea, there is a race of bird people called the Rito, which are said to would be descended from the Zora, who were, like, a race of sort of fish people from the earlier games. But I guess that, like, after the flood, it was easier for that, like, instead of evolving from freshwater fish people to saltwater fish people, it was just easier to evolve into birds.
Oh,
I guess.
Sure. So yeah, birds, people, fish.
Mm-hmm.
Historia et veritas.
So the other thing that I wanted to talk about more historically speaking, and we'll now move into the Historia et veritas, is that, of course, we can't pass up the opportunity to do a deeper dive into discussion of pirates.
Yar.
Yar.
Yo ho ho. Or does no one actually say that?
A bottle of rum. So we are in 1699, right in what is called the Golden Age of Piracy. So this then allows them to do all your classic pirate stereotypes, including, of course, the Jolly Roger, right? So the pirate flag with the skull and crossbones, which would have been used to signal the identity of a pirate ship. Pirates, of course, I will note, are not in fact all fun and games. They not only have fun robbing ships, but also, kill people and sexually assault people, etc. We tend to often get a fairly romanticized vision of pirates. I would say this is sort of somewhat in between. It's not really a fully romanticized version like we have in something like Pirates of the Caribbean, for example. But it does still present them as ultimately fairly sympathetic, but I think in ways that actually are kind of interesting in terms of the actual kind of like social and class dynamics that would push people potentially toward piracy during this period.
They like they don't shy away from like, yeah, we steal and kill, but I mean they don't actually show much of that because
No.
they're getting picked off one by one by an alien siren thing. But
Right. The pirates are the real victims here in this particular
I
serial.
mean, yeah, kinda.
The other thing that is, I think, important to talk about piracy during this period in particular, but in a lot of context, that the boundaries between piracy, warfare, government-sponsored economic sabotage of one's political enemies are often blurred. So, and this, goes back pretty far. So that certainly, for example, in terms of, things that I actually know something about in the late medieval and early modern period, it is quite common for Christian and Muslim corsairs to attack one another's ships, often with either overt government sponsorship or at least tacit government approval. And they both steal one another's goods and then also take a lot of captives, with the idea that the captives who have families with some amount of money will ransom them, which is a good money maker. And the captives that don't have any money will then be sold as slaves. And this is, in fact, an important part of the Mediterranean slave trade. Part of also the kind of dynamic of the Mediterranean slave trade is that Christians can enslave Muslims but aren't supposed to enslave Christians, and vice versa.
With an exception for the Greeks.
Yep, with the exception,
Eastern
right, that the
Christians
Greek
don't count.
Christians don't count as real Christians, so that's fine. Great. But piracy, right, is an important part of this, and that it is absolutely something, right, that is considered to be essentially okay from a government perspective, as long as their activities are properly targeted. There is, of course, also the history of, the British Admiralty issuing these letters of marque to privateers, so people who command these privately owned armed ships, and that basically, then allow them and encourage them, right, to go and capture enemy merchant vessels without being charged as piracy. And then also then, from the government's perspective, it's not an act of war because, well, this is like a private agent, but also he's kind of our agent.
I mean, it makes sense from like a government budgetary standpoint because standing navies are expensive as hell.
Yeah.
I went into this at least a little bit when we covered the Church and the Crown, and I was talking about the Duke of Buckingham, who was Lord Admiral at the time. But much easier and cheaper than building up ships and maintaining ships as a navy is to just like requisition like privately owned ships and say, hey, you're gonna serve in the navy for the course of this war, and the captain of the ship's like, what do I get out of it? And it's like, you can take the stuff of the people you attack. That's how you're gonna get your pay, and we will give you a thumbs up and a pat on the back and a letter of mark over it.
So it has that benefit in outright context of war and in context where they're not officially, also they're not friends. It's like, this is how you fuck with them. And like, you're not declaring war, and like, it's not really a government-sponsored attack, but also it kind of is. Yeah, so it's fun. And then, of course, in the Caribbean, What is happening specifically is that British governors of care of the like various Caribbean islands are paying locals to capture Spanish ships that have treasure, basically to fuck with the Spanish, because the British love fucking with the Spanish. Which, you know, fair. But then, you know, the problem with that is that soon they're like, why should we only attack the Spanish ships as opposed to like all the ships?
True. Yeah. And like the Spanish treasure fleet is always the like big target, because it's carrying like all of the silver from the South American silver mines back to Spain to completely destroy their economy with hyperinflation, because they don't understand
Yay.
Inflation yet.
Hey.
Woo! Go
Spain.
Spain.
Mm. And piracy then also offers some real benefits to people. And that's actually one of the things that I think is interesting, is that we have this guy who, you know, is portrayed ultimately, right, as being somebody who is fundamentally motivated by greed. But it also points to the fact that given kind of real class dynamics and economic issues at this period in England, there are reasons one might become a pirate or find piracy attractive if you come from these sort of lower socioeconomic ranks of society. Conditions are overcrowded, especially in, you know, major cities like London. It is often difficult to find work. There is, you know, there's reason to think that people might have experienced life in major English cities at this point as relatively bleak if you did not have a lot of money. And piracy, therefore, provides a pretty good opportunity to not only make money, but also, like, you get adventure and you get to, you know, have some kind of control where you might not otherwise. And, like, I don't know, be your own boss, I guess, sort of. Depending on where you are in the pirate hierarchy. So, and it also would have definitely had an allure for people that maybe started as like regular sailors or even, you know, in the Navy, that then are like, you know how I can make a whole lot more money? Piracy.
Yep. I also have another fun fact about how pirates are portrayed in media more than anything. So, because it's the part that sticks out into the Atlantic, most English sailors who are like impressed into naval service come from the English Southwest, in particular Devon and Cornwall. I think a majority of them come from a combination of Devon, Somerset, and Cornwall, which is why the stereotypical pirate accent is just the Cornish accent. Like, it is the regional Cornish accent, because like that is where, more than any other county in Britain, that is where more pirates end up coming from than anywhere else.
Just fascinating.
So that's where the pirate accent comes from. That and one of the earliest, well, the earliest movie adaptation of Treasure Island. The actor playing Long John Silver made a choice to, in an era where every English actor like uses the standard King's English, like he made a conscious choice to keep his natural Cornish accent, and it was so distinctive that like everyone since has latched onto that as a yes, pirate voice.
That's interesting. And then I will also note, of course, that while, you know, in right our image of pirates and in, you know, the context of this particular episode, I've talked mostly about European Englishy pirates. But of course, piracy can be found all over. Everybody can be a pirate.
Fabula Nostra,
which actually is a good lead into my Fabula Nostra, which
yeah,
for
go
once
on, go for it.
I put, I don't know, moderate effort into. Really, that I was like, all right, I would like to find a pirate who is not a man, and also preferably like not white. So I found a woman named Lala Aisha al-Alami, who was also known as Sayyida al-Hura, a term that basically just means like a woman who independently exercises sovereign authority, who has at least some kind of interesting connections to piracy. So not necessarily somebody who is sailing the high seas herself, but somebody who is an important sponsor of piracy at least. So she's born in like late 1480s, right at the beginning of the 1490s, in the Muslim Emirate of Granada. So this is the very, very last Muslim kingdom in what is now Spain, conquered in 1492 by Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile.
Yeah, it's the very end of Granada too, so.
Yes. She, of course, then, when she was very young, this conquest takes place. And her family fled. So, and in the context, right, of the actual history of Granada, there is initially kind of fairly decent terms extended to the Muslim population of Granada. This ends up going away relatively quickly. So some people just kind of preemptively flee. A lot of people then are pushed out quite soon after. But so, you know, but within essentially the kind of next decade or essentially out of the con out of the after this conquest, right, we're basically kind of talking at the end of open Muslim life in the Iberian Peninsula.
Right.
Her family then flees, and so she ends up in North Africa, ends up marrying a much older man, Sidi El-Mandri, who is the governor of the city of Tetuan. And he then dies long before she does, as is often the case when you have marriages between a much younger man and or a much older man and a much younger woman. And she ends up ruling independently as the government of Tetuan for a pretty long period of her life, and actually then eventually ends up like marrying this like sultan who is based in Fez, and he is apparently the first sultan who like doesn't who like marries a woman who does not like move to Fez, because she's like, no, I'm still the governor of Tetuan and I'm like gonna continue to stay there. So she is cool. And she also is kind of partnering up with this Ottoman corsair who is nicknamed Barbarossa or Redbeard to use piracy as a means of enriching herself, securing the safety of her territory, and enacting vengeance against the Christians who have driven her and her family from her home, which I think is awesome.
Fair, yeah, no, that's respect, yeah.
Yeah, so she is my new favorite person, and I want a movie about her.
Nice. Yeah.
So what is your Fabula Nostra?
I kind of had two not entirely formed ideas. The first one is another Doctor Who episode, basically catching up with Captain Avery and his crew as they sail the stars and finding out what they've been getting up to. The other one is less an episode and more a character. Like I want to see another, like I want to see more companions who are not from present day Britain. Because Amy is Scottish, so that's England. Not anyway,
United Kingdom.
yeah, United Kingdom. Like I want, more importantly, I want someone who's not from the present day. Like so like I would love to see like a pirate companion. I don't know, like someone who hails from the 17th century, ends up coming along with the doctor, like figures out how the TARDIS works better than most companions because of that experience as a sailor, but also has a bit of like sticky fingers, and the doctor has to like say, give that back.
And as a kind of tie-in or connection, it actually could be interesting if something like that happened with Typhoid Toby.
True.
That, like, if he
Yeah.
grows up and, I don't know, somewhere in the stars cures his typhoid fever,
Maybe.
and then could join up with the doctor et al.
Yeah. I don't think he would go pirate, though. Not
Who
Toby.
knows?
Who knows?
He's pretty young. Like, continued exposure to like pirate role models.
True.
Be good. I could see him going pirate.
Yeah.
Estimatio.
So at this point, we can rate this episode on a scale from 1 to 5 based on whatever purely subjective criteria we see fit. I think I'm probably settling at this point on a 4. And so that's part I thought the twist was really interesting and liked that aspect of things and found this to be a really just like fun and engaging episode. I think to some extent, my rating is potentially unfair. I am coming from the perspective of watching weird, like Doctor Who episodes in isolation without context of previous seasons.
That doesn't help.
Yeah, so like this was an episode, right, where like I thought at least, you know, the dynamic between Amy and Rory previously wasn't good, but I thought like they came off as much more interesting in a lot of ways in Vampires of Venice, where you get more of their backstory, whereas here it's just like they've been around for a while and they kind of just seem like a sort of boring married couple. Like as companions go, they didn't come off as that fun in this particular episode.
True. They have more to do elsewhere in the season, but this episode is really the Doctor and Captain Avery show.
Yeah, exactly. So because of that, like we also then like have an episode where it like is also kind of like the man show.
Yeah. That's also,
And it's also again like this is again like a way in which like watching these episodes in isolation, you know, I don't get a fair like a totally fair picture of them, but like I don't know, it just seems like there's like all of these questions about like what's happening with the TARDIS and like all of this like weird stuff at the end, and I'm like I don't know, I feel like there's like a lot going on that I just like don't actually know anything about.
No, series 6 does that. All the seasons in the new series like have some little clever thing in the background that keeps popping up, and then at the end of the season you're like, "Oh, that's how all of this fits together." Like all that thing we kept hearing, that's how it's fits in. Series 6 in my opinion does that too much.
Yeah,
It's
and
got
if
like the is Amy pregnant or not mystery, which is a dumb plot line. It's got Eye Patch Lady. It's got the doctor dying at the beginning. How is he gonna weasel out of it this time? He couldn't regenerate. It's got just all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and I in general do tend to be of the opinion that in shows where the strength is an interesting, essentially new plot in every episode, I tend to think that a then overemphasis on your kind of overarching plot line that goes through an entire season actually tends to often be less interesting. And like in that sort of show. And as I said, in this situation in particular, it is also made like far less interesting by the fact that I am watching it in isolation and don't like have that that wider context. So, yeah.
The wider context, this specific season, it can get kind of dumb. No, I'm not the hugest fan of Series 6 just overall, but this
Yeah.
episode in isolation, I'll give it a 4.5 because aside from the fact that it's part of Series 6 and it has to tie into Series 6, I liked everything else. Like the pirates are fun and engaging characters. Toby's great. Like it's got a good twist. Not one that Doctor Who has never done before, but
That was a cool twist. I
but
actually will
it
say, I
worked out.
actually didn't adore Toby. Like, Toby just seemed like the kind of like kid that we're supposed to care about because one's supposed to care about children.
Yeah, that's fair.
But that's also like maybe my thing. I can see why other people might like Toby more.
Yeah, he was like, I want to say with like the costuming decisions, he looks he's. He is dressed and has the hairstyle. He looks exactly like almost every film version of Jim Hawkins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun.
I also enjoy that like that callback to a 1966 serial that no one has seen.
Right. No, I think that is a
Captain
really
Amory's
fun
treasure.
touch. Yeah. And I think that is also like I like a really cool thing that like you don't need to know that reference to still enjoy the episode, but if it's a fun touch for people who do. Like I like things like that on principle.
Yeah, the Smugglers has the dubious distinction of having the lowest viewing figures of any Doctor Who serial.
Ooh.
Not
Too bad.
Through no inherent fault of its own, like viewership had been like kind of on a steady decline until the serial after that, like sort of sparked new interest in the show because it featured the show's first regeneration. So we got some literal new blood in the form of Patrick Troughton. And we got an interesting new villain in that serial in the form of the Cybermen, who would go on to be like one of the most iconic recurring threats. But yeah.
All right.
Fun statistics fact.
Yeah. And interesting that that's also where they went with like a reference from, right? Is the thing that like is kind of, I guess, maybe more for the diehard fans.
Because, like, well, and also it's one of the missing serials, so it's not like you can go back and watch it.
Yeah.
That's not an option.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it is, like, one of the, it's the first, and I think in the classic series, only time that they do real historical pirates. They've done space pirates several times, but this is like the only time they did real pirates.
Yeah. Fun. Well, it was nice to have an excuse to talk about pirates for the first time on this podcast. I'll have to do Muppet Treasure Island one of these days.
Yes.
I love that movie as a kid.
Muppet Treasure Island. When Absolutely. You are a professional pirate.
Yeah. So Lily, thank you for joining me once again. What is our next Doctor Who, just to get a...
Good question.
Sorry, I know I put you on the spot.
So the next one in the new series is definitely not going to be our next one.
Okay.
Because the next one in the new series is The Day of the Doctor. And that one... It's the 50th anniversary special.
Oh.
There's groundwork we need to lay. But
okay.
I am confident that we can.
Okay.
But either we are going to go back to the classic series or the audio dramas next.
Okay.
And I haven't decided which to do next.
Gonna okay.
Be either The Romans, City of Death, or Seasons of Fear.
All right. Sounds good. Well, so keep that in mind. So, Lily, this is where the listeners can find you on the internet.
They're welcome to try. No, I have, unlike Ollie, who has no social media presence whatsoever.
Ollie, who has an Instagram where he has never posted anything.
I have a Tumblr. I am Shadow Academic on Tumblr. There is no theme to my blog. It's just whatever I come across. Otherwise, there's the Media Evil Facebook group, and that's kind of it. That's kind of it anymore.
All right. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe in your preferred podcatcher app and rate and review. I'll read new 5-star reviews in future episodes. Please also follow the podcast on Twitter/X and join the Facebook group. It really is one of these days. Project to get different, better social media, but I'm really busy. I've got a lot of writing deadlines. I'm going up for tenure next year. There's a lot happening. So, you know.
It's busy. It's a busy time for all of us.
Yep. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Sarah Ifchdecker. If you have any questions or suggestions, I'd love to hear from you via email at media.evilpod@gmail.com. So, Lily, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yes.
Yes. And thank you all for listening to Media Evil. Bye.
Bye. Do 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 do.